Imagine a religion that is characterized in a large way by the comedic nature of its stories. Myths that have heroes who are as foolish as they are wise. In some ways, a spiritual precursor to slapstick comedy. Hi, my name is Leo, and today on Culture Shocking Stories, we will learn about the Anishinaabe and their myths, as well as, inevitably, the effects of colonialism and what it means to tell these stories today. So before we discuss their stories, we need to talk about who the Anishinaabe are. After all, no good story is complete without its context, so it's time to get some. Culture Shocking History. The Anishinaabe, also known as the Ojibwe or Chippewa, are a group of Native Americans found near the Great Lakes region in both the U.S. and Canada. For the 2020 U.S. Census, around 130,000 people in the U.S. identify at least in part as Chippewa, and their historical location gave them considerable power over the fur trade in that part of the world until the treaties were signed for them to live on reservations. Their location provided a unique culture tied to the land. The harsh, food-scarce winters promoted ideas like the Wendigo, a warning against consuming human flesh, but also the more lighthearted community-building sentiments. As Carrie Miller describes in Power in the Anishinaabe World, being pitied is one of the most prized possessions in Anishinaabe society. The best thing to be is to be cared about. People are expected to be as interconnected with their community as possible, to help and be helped, to take care of people in your clan as family in times of need, even if you are not strictly biologically related. The Anishinaabe held the reservation communally, living off the land as they needed. But this was disturbed beginning in 1889, when the Nelson Act forced private ownership of reservation land through the process of allotment. As written in Melissa L. Myers' Jack Pine, White Pine, and Porcupine, all surplus reservation lands not allotted, which included most of the reservation, would be surveyed and sold at public auction. In many cases, the surveyors misrepresented the value of the land in cases of collusion with private corporations, allowing for lumber companies to buy the land up cheap, clear them of their trees, and move on. And in the end, the actual tribal members got a minority of their reservation. That's the background. The loss of land and disease brought on tremendous hardship for the Anishinaabe, continuing even to this day. But though reservation life may be tough, their culture, exampled in their myths, maintain a comedic view on the world. One common character shared through the many Anishinaabe stories is Nanabujju or Nanapush, a trickster and a wise fool. Let's listen to two different readings of Nanabujju and the Ducks to get a sense of what it's like. Here first is read by Frank Blissett from the book Ojibwa Myths and Tales by 1 G.E. Laidlaw. Link to the video in the description.
A long time ago, Nanabush, when out hunting ducks, came to a lake. He saw a nice bay, curved all along to the end, which we all know how bays are not straight. And in this bay there were a lot of ducks sitting along the shore, and Nanabush would like to kill them all with one shot. He did not know how to do it. He thought that he must get them all. He looked at his gun, which was straight, and he thought if he could bend his gun, he might get them all. He went to work and bent his gun. He got close and made a good aim, pulled the trigger, and bang! When the smoke cleared away, there were no ducks to be seen, dead or alive. Nanabush got so mad that he made another plan. He and his mother made a big camp and invited all the different kinds of ducks to come to a big dance on such a day set apart for the dance. All of the ducks came, and when they came up, Nanabush started to sing a song. Before the dance started, he told the ducks that they had to keep their eyes closed when they danced and had to dance around the middle of the camp. Nanabush seated himself near the door, and as the ducks would dance near him, he would grab them and twist their necks and throw them behind him, and got quite a lot this time.
And here next is read by Edna Manituwabi from Wabano Center. Link, once again, is in the description.
He comes on to the ducks that are out by the water. They're enjoying themselves. They're playing in the water, and he decides to think of a way that he could entice them over. And he gets over there by the shore and calls out to them to come and play. Come and have some fun. What about a dance? Let's make a dance. Let's have a fire dance. And so they came and they wanted to say, okay, we'll play with you and we'll come and dance with you. And so they started up a fire, and then he tells them, dance. We're going to dance. But you have to close your eyes. Close your eyes and don't open until I tell ya. He gets all of them and then he puts them in the fire. He decides while he's waiting for his meal to get roasted and the ducks to be ready for his feast, he decides, well, he's gonna have a nap. He asked his bum, now, you keep an eye on the food. Don't let them get overdone. I'm going to have a little rest, a little shut-eye, and have a little nap. So he turns over, asks his bum to watch the fire, to watch the ducks. But of course, bum being bum, falls asleep too. And lo and behold, somebody was watching all along, saw the whole process, decided to come along and pull everything out, all the ducks out, and just left the bones. Finally, Nenebush woke up, and he was going to enjoy his meal. No, that was not to be. He got mad at his bottom there. I told you to look after this. How come you didn't do that? And look what happened. We can't enjoy our meal. There's nothing to eat. Just for that, I'm going to punish you. What a way to punish. He burnt his bum.
When it comes to hiring, don't search for great talent. Match with them, thanks to Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed, and it's because hiring is such a difficult thing. And sometimes it makes me want to pull out my hair trying to find a perfect candidate for a job. But with Indeed, it happens quickly and easily. It makes hiring all in one place so much easier. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join the more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/A-list. Just go to Indeed.com/A-list right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/A-list. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. But why is it like this? To answer this question, I asked Adam Spry, Anishinaabe author of Our War Paint is Writer's Ink, Anishinaabe Literary Transnationalism, and professor teaching Indigenous Literature at Emerson College. Thank you for being on this podcast. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
What do you think is the effect of this comedic vision of the world and like the stories that it's told? Why do you think it is like this?
Most of the recorded and sort of anthologized Anishinaabe stories we have a degree of comedy or irony in them. And it's something that a lot of Anishinaabe scholars have sort of focused on thinking about, you know, this, as you said, comedic vision. And, you know, there's a couple different ways you could approach the question. One is sort of structuralist, and the other one is sort of less so, more sort of amorphous. I mean, in terms of sort of the structural determinants, comedy derives often from being confronted with the unexpected, with something that you didn't think or imagine could happen. And I've heard that described, that aspect of Anishinaabe storytelling described as like just a response to sort of the material conditions that the Anishinaabe lived in, right?
Like when food is scarce and it's just kind of complicated trying to survive in certain conditions, right?
Yeah. And so you have to be able to kind of roll with punches, right? You have to be able to adapt, accept the unexpected. And that I think is a compelling sort of, you know, analysis, structural analysis, right? But the sort of more cultural analysis is the idea that humor is a great way of building community relations, right? Of getting people to bond together and to share, you know, laughter, right? There's a reason why we like to be in places, even with complete strangers together, when we're experiencing humor. So a movie's always funny in the theater with a crowd than it is at home on the couch, right? And so, you know, I think you can combine those two into sort of a decent sort of explanation for the comedy. At the same time, too, it's just fun, especially if you're considering a culture that lived in a place where, like, life was hard, especially in the winter. Having a chance to laugh and cut loose is important.
But like their land, Anishinaabe culture has always been under threat. So what does it mean to bring the culture to modern times, especially after the tremendous effects of colonialism? Do you think that, because obviously as the years have gone on, this sort of like more traditional storytelling has not like disappeared, but has gotten less prominent?
I mean, couple centuries of colonialism is going to lead to loss. At the same time, you know, adaptation is such an important part of Anishinaabe culture, right? The ability to sort of kind of dialectically move through time, understanding that, you know, surviving going forward is the ultimate value, you know, protect life, stay alive as long as you can, that sort of thing, right? And so, like, are stories told the same way they would have been told 250 years ago? No, not as much, right? That being said, you know, there are still people coming up with new Nanabuju stories, even in the language. You know, I've encountered Nanabuju stories of Nanabuju, like, stealing motorcycles and playing baseball, right? And those are not traditional stories, right, at all. But I also think, like, the avenues for sort of that cultural humor or that sort of cultural form of storytelling have diversified for sure. We still have, you know, people telling funny and dirty stories, you know, just among themselves orally. But there's also people like the late Jim Northrup, who was from Fond du Lac Reservation in Minnesota, who had like a newspaper column that he wrote called Fond du Lac Follies, which was sort of, you know, it was personal essay writing, but also with this humorous sort of satirical edge, right, that he was publishing in the local newspaper for his community, that I think in some ways is an extension of that sort of storytelling tradition, that sort of communal storytelling tradition. You know, similarly, there's, you know, even younger Anishinaabe people, like I'm thinking about Adam and Zach Khalil, who are filmmakers from the Sault Ste. Marie Reservation, who have been playing around with this sort of ironic, comedic tradition in the form of film, right? They're making these short films like Enough to Say or The Violence of a Civilization Without Secrets or any number of these things. And they directly say that they're being inspired by Nanabuju stories.
Clearly, as you're saying, like people have sort of adopted kind of culture and I guess mixed it in some ways, would you say, with your American sort of sensibilities in terms of storytelling?
You know, it does go both ways. It's not just completely assimilating to one or the other pole, right? And so I think we have to be really careful with the idea of identifying like a sort of purity.
People are complicated and communities are made up of lots of different types of people and lots of different types of ways of thinking. Stories defines our worldview, which is true in somewhat, but also we define stories that we tell.
In being a little bit hesitant or a little bit skeptical, I should say, of authenticity, it allows us to recognize the legitimacy of these sort of transformations as they occur, as continuities rather than disjunctions. I think one of the big things that kind of impacts the way we think about Indigenous stories, and something you've kind of already mentioned, is we have this expectation that they are somehow equivalent to canonical religious sentiments. We have this expectation that because these are stories that deal with something of the divine, something of the creation and maintenance of the world as we understand it, that they must be sort of inviolate, right? They must be sort of, there's something there that could be profaned, a sacredness that could potentially be profaned.
One thing that is very interesting is like storytelling as sort of like, I guess, like cultural sovereignty, or like trying to define yourself as separate from the people around you. So I think it's possible to argue that, you know, as assimilation continues, or like as adaptation even continues, that even if both sides change, eventually there's going to be some sort of equalizing point. How do you adapt and change while also maintaining an essential Anishinaabe-ness, I guess? What do you think that is? Or like, is that even definable?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and my opinion on this is probably not going to be very representative and going to be pretty idiosyncratic, right? But I don't know if questions of sovereignty can be answered in culture. Like, I don't know if it's something that can be done primarily through like storytelling or even like language, right? Like, I'm of the opinion that, you know, the sovereignty of Indigenous peoples relies primarily on sort of material and political consideration. There's the attempt to sort of preserve a cultural tradition when you've lost sort of the material basis for that culture. It can be akin to like sort of taking an item out of a museum and preserving it, not so much so that you can continue to sort of have the cultural relevance of the material object, but so you can kind of remember what its purpose was in the past. This is sort of a weird anecdote, but like back in the 30s, like, or 20s or 30s, Franz Boas, the anthropologist, like, stole, I mean, that's maybe the best word for it, took a item from my wife's people, the Tlingit, that was like a ceremonially important object. I think it was a mask. He wrote about it in his journals. He was like, oh, it's so sad that these people won't be able to do the ceremonies associated with this mask anymore, but we need to preserve it to understand their way of life because it's disappearing and all that sort of stuff. And it's this very melancholic sort of thing. And then he goes back like 5 years later or something like that to the same community, and they just carved a new mask. I bring that up to talk about, like, you know, a lot of these stories, what they do on a sort of symbolic level is reflect on a sort of world and natural environment, material environment that Anishinaabe people lived in, right? How, you know, how bear got a short tail, or how rabbit got a long ears, or all that sort of stuff. They may not serve a sort of real genuine explanatory function for how those things came to be, but they are reflective of a sort of the relationship that communities have with specific species or specific environments, right? And so as long as those relationships between the land and the people maintain, like, the stories will come out of it. Right. The storytelling tradition will continue. But that's what we risk when we lose sight of the sort of material aspect, is like, what can, like, a specifically Anishinaabe storytelling tradition exist without any sort of reference or without any sort of connection to the land? And I'm not saying no, but I am saying, like, it'll be different, and maybe different to the point where it stops being identifiably in line or in continuous with prior storytelling traditions.
Although the fight for Indigenous people's rights are nowhere near its end, this podcast must come to one. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Culture Shocking Stories. I strongly recommend looking at the links in the description for more information on the topic. And as always, I'll see you next week.
Thank you.